now, our main speaker, let's give a big welcome for Pete, all the way from San Diego.
Good evening, family. My name is Pete, and I'm an alcoholic. my sobriety date is November 17th of 2010. My home group is called Sobriety on State and Date. We meet on Thursday nights in Little Italy in San Diego. We are Zoom. I'd love to maybe drop the information if any of you guys would like to come and join us down there. And I have a sponsor. His name is Ali. And first and foremost, just really excited to be here. Thanks so much for the invite, Layla. Great to see you. Happy birthday. May 28th is my belly button birthday, which is far less significant than the sobriety day, but that's a good day. So congratulations on that. And Nick, welcome, man. We're really glad you're here. And Paula knocked that one out the park. I do know your brother from the last name. And the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. It's solid sobriety. I attest to your brand of AA. I liked everything I heard. I can relate a lot to a lot of it. When I'm asked to speak, I have the honor or privilege to speak, or I pick up a chip, I always say those three things about my sobriety date, my home group, and my and then I have a sponsor. And I think one of the reasons I did that is I'll tell you a little bit about it. But you know, I spent the better part of 7 years in and around AA, but never really doing AA. Just kind of here hanging out, drinking your coffee, and you know, putting a dollar in the basket, and you know, rambling some incoherence if called upon. But I never really participated. And I think when I get a sobriety date and stick to it, and I have a sponsor and I have a home group, I mean, it certainly doesn't mean I'm going to be sober for forever, but it's a pretty good indication that maybe I'm taking some type of direction, some type of action. So I always like to say that. And I love when people share their date. And Paula, thanks for doing that. I'm glad to be here. You know, I was talking to a buddy who joined me virtually, took a little drive up north virtually. I love the Central Coast, man. You guys have beautiful country up there. And I wish I could be up there in person with you guys. But I was talking to my buddy who joined the call. And, you know, I was like, I don't know what to tell you, man. Like, I'm incredibly blessed. I had twins. Well, my wife had twins on April 10th. I haven't slept for about 2 months, and have my family's pretty sick. You know, we all get like some head congestions. Please excuse me. I'll probably have a cough drop or two in here, bad etiquette, but I do what I got to do. And I appreciate your patience. But you know, the thing about AA is that we just show up regardless, you know, virtually or in person, phone calls, meetings, whatever it looks like. And I've been taught, the literature suggests that, you know, and what I can tell you a little bit here is, you know, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I like to take that very literally. A lot of people say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And not to get too, you know, bent out of shape, but that's not what it says. You know, it says what we were like, what I was like, you know, because it, for me, I don't know about you guys, but for me, it doesn't change. It hasn't changed. Paula talked that a little bit. You know, that 40 ounce has not changed, and it won't. And neither will where the places we go, or the dive bars we went, or the couches we slept on, or the people we hung out with. Like, it has not changed. Either I have changed or I haven't. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the people within it and the principles within it have helped to facilitate a change in me that I can attest to nothing else besides this beautiful fellowship that we have. And Paula said, I was, you know, checks out Paula's sobriety day. I was like, man, she got sober when she was like 8. You know, you're pretty young. Good for you, you know. And I like to say, I got sober when I was 24, and then I got drunk, and then I got sober when I was 25, and then I got drunk, and I did that all the way until I was 30. You know, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 24 in Boulder County Jail off of my first DUI. And so needless to say, the 5 years prior to that, 6 years prior to that, were not terrible, but certainly not great. I certainly had inclinations of alcoholism and alcohol abuse. And I come from a really strong family, a really good background. I've been afforded, you know, uncountable opportunities in life. And there's nothing from my background that says like, this dude should be an alcoholic. Youngest of three, and no one in my immediate family is an alcoholic. And, you know, there's some far reaching aunts and uncles and such who might, and, you know, I don't know how how much I really held on too much to like the genetic aspect of it. I think, you know, I think there's something to be said about that, but I don't think it plays that big of a role. You know, I mean, I think there's people who have zero alcoholics in their family and they are alcoholic if they choose to identify. And then people come from long lines who don't. And it's a weird line that we cross. And I crossed it, you know, and I went to that jail, 24 years old, Boulder County. And I was there for 28 days in jail. There was other charges. They normally don't keep you 28 days on a DUI only, but there was other charges. But I figured out pretty quick that I'm not built for jail. And I went to a program called Phoenix Program. And it was for incarcerated people who wanted to turn their life around. Now, I didn't want to turn my life around. I just didn't want to be in general population with like the real, you know, criminals, you know, that I was terrified of, because I can put on a pretty good fake tough guy look, but it doesn't work well in certain circumstances like jail. So I went to this program and I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a gentleman brought something in. It's called H&I. I'm sure you all know about it. Hospitals and institutions. And a guy on his own free will and representing nothing but Alcoholics Anonymous came in and shared his story and brought a book. And it was my first introduction to AA. And I got a book and I read it and I started like flipping through pages, and it's weird. I still have that book today, and I see things that I circled and highlighted from, you know, 2005, 2006, 2007 that was interesting to me at the time, but I didn't stay sober for a long time. And I got out of jail and I did what like a good tough guy, 24-year-old does. And I moved back home to my parents' house in their basement, and they were like, no drinking, no smoking, no drugs. You had to go to AA and get some counseling. And I was like, you got it. You know, and I was drunk within a couple of days. You know, powerlessness is a funny thing when you don't really know how it kind of manifests itself in your life. You know, I thought for a long time that I had just changed my mind. I'm not drinking today. And then come noon or two or three or four, whatever it is, like I've just changed my mind. I thought I wasn't going to drink. And now I've decided I'm going to drink. And I did that for years, you know, and I was truly bewildered at the nature of my relationship with alcohol, and I didn't have anything else to put on it. I love the line of the doctor's opinion. He talks about frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices, right? And I'm always a fan of saying who usually provides this frothy emotional appeal. In my experience, it's usually our family and the people that love us the most. My parents used to say things like this: "You can do it, man. You know, we love you, Pete. You know, it just." You know, you can do this, you can do this. And they meant it and they love me, you know, and it didn't work, you know, and God bless them. How would they know any differently? You know, they just tried the best they could. And it was a wild ride for a couple of years there. You know, I worked in bars for a long time. I had a lot of the repercussions that a lot of us have, I guess, to greater or lesser extents, you know, jails, locked up. Paula was talking about ankle braces. Haven't thought about that in a while, but had that. You know, I got out of Boulder County Jail and I was on house arrest, and I had to go to a place twice a day to get breathalyzers. And I was getting drunk within 2 or 3 days, and finding scheming ways around breathalyzers. There's ways to do it. I remember I walked into a meeting in Boulder County when I got out of that jail, and it was in a church. It was one of my first, like, you know, real AA meetings, I guess you can call it that, like in the real world. And I walked in and I was the first one there. I was probably 20, 30 minutes earlier. And there was an elderly lady at the front, like sitting at the desk. I'm sure she was a secretary. And I don't know if it's exactly how it went, but this is how I remember it. I think I kicked the door open, right? Like it's like old West style, kicked the door open. And I was like, who's in charge here? Or something like that, you know? And like, she looks up from her glasses at me, like real clean, like, and she points up. And then she goes right back to her notes. And like, what a great introduction to AA, you know, because I think there's some board here. I think there's some, you know, people who run things are probably taking my information down. And I was I looked very askew and askance at people in AA. Like, why are you extending your hand to me? Why are you giving me your number? Why are you asking for my number? This is weird. This is strange. And, you know, they talk about, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Now, if you read the preambles and the forewords, what it says originally, it says an honest desire to stop drinking. They dropped that, right? The only requirement is an honest desire to stop drinking. We don't say it anymore, but originally when the book was written, that's what it had. And I you know, I haven't talked to Bill, but I think that the reason they kind of shifted that is because it needs to be more inclusive. If you ask me if I honestly want to stop when I'm 24 or 21 or even 28, no, I don't honestly want to stop. Like, I honestly just want my job back. I honestly want to get off parole. You know, I want to, you know, I honestly just want you guys to leave me alone and let me drink in peace. You know, so, and I don't think the newcomer, I certainly didn't, and many of the ones I meet, they don't know what honesty is. I didn't know what honesty is. I thought I was a good guy. You know, I thought I worked hard and I was a good dude and a good son. And, you know, and I was, you know, this was just my lot. You know, alcoholism was just my lot. And I had to be taught and learn otherwise, you know. Went back to D.C., where I'm from originally, and I was living there for a while. And, you know, Paula had told that story about the train, and I have a similar one where I somehow got a job. I don't even know how I got it. I was working in a little town called Wheaton, Maryland, just outside of D.C., in like a call center. And I was sober for like, I don't know, let's say 3 weeks, maybe not very long at all. Didn't have a sponsor, going to meetings just sporadically, just kind of showing up. And I went to work and my brother was coming in. He lived in San Diego at the time. And backtrack real quick. I moved to San Diego. I got another DUI and then I moved home again. So that's kind of my MO too. I get in trouble and then I run back home to my parents' house. And my brother was coming to town. And I went to work and I left work and I was going to meet my parents and my brother at a steakhouse in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I got on a train with no intentions of drinking at all. And I got off the train and I could literally see the steakhouse. It must have been 50 yards away from the train station. And I stopped in a bar and I got two beers and two shots. And it just didn't even pass my mind. Like this is probably one of the worst times I could be drinking, you know. Going to meet these people who are putting me up, even though I've messed up again, you know, and they're kind of like the last people on that are willing to give me a choice or a chance. And I got drunk. And the next morning, my dad kicked me out the house. And I was 24 at the time. I was 30 years old at the time. So I spent those 6 years going in and out of AA. And I got to remember that too. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of alcoholics meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I had court slips. I'd do it for me. I had a sponsor one time for a couple months. I didn't really utilize him as a resource. And I just hung out around AA. You know, some people say meeting makers make it. I understand the thought and theory behind that. But I tell you what, I went to a lot of meetings and I didn't make it, you know. I went to a lot of meetings and I didn't make it. I used to be into fitness when I was in shape. And I always equate it to like having a gym membership. I mean, some of us have gym memberships. Some of us use them, you know. And it's the thought of I go to the gym. I put a towel around my head or around my shoulders. I sit in the lobby for an hour, right? I probably even have a protein shake, right? And then I look at my clock and the hour's up and I walk out. And I say, well, great workout, you know, and then I wonder why I'm not getting fit. And I wonder why I'm not losing weight. And you know, and I say things like this, this gym doesn't work for me, you know, and this is how I treated AA. You know, I showed up and I sat for an hour and I didn't participate and I didn't do any of the things. And you don't get fit in a gym like that. And you sure as hell don't get sober in AA like that. I don't, at least. So, I mean, I had to really understand that there was a lot of action that needed to be taken, you know, within the rooms of AA, within the spiritual program that's presented to me, to be able to get the benefits and the promises that you all have been telling me about for forever. You know, my dad kicked me out the house the next day after I got drunk at the steakhouse. My dad's a pretty tough guy, man, like, you know, veteran and you know, 30 years working for USDA. And I seen him cry twice in his life. And one was once when his dad died, and the other time was when he kicked me out of his house. And it was devastating. And I was, you know, snot crying. And I was like, I don't need you guys. And you're leaving me at my worst time, you know, and self-pity nonsense. And he got on a plane and went to Africa. He was leaving for work, man. And man, it was terrible. It was very sad. And And I mentioned his trip, man, because when he left, I went and squatted on some people's couch for about 6 days. And I called my mom. I'll never forget this because it was November in D.C. And it was cold and rainy. And I was wearing sweatpants and I was in a fetal position behind a payphone. Nick and some of these other young people don't know what a payphone is, right? But it was it's a phone outside. And I was laying in a puddle, literally in a puddle of water, of rainwater and sweatpants. On a phone asking my mom to come pick me up. And I'm pretty convinced my dad and I are very tight and, you know, he loves me a lot, but I know if he was in town, he probably would not have done it. Good for him. You know, but my mom, she's my mom. So she came and picked me up, man. And she let me sleep on her couch for 2 days. And then I went into a facility for the alcoholic insane. Some people call them treatment centers. And that's where I went. And they took my shoes and my belt, my shoelaces and my belt, you know, because I'm that kind of guy. And I spent 28 days in that location. And I should mention that there was members from the local community who would also bring meetings in there. Again, H&I. I have a very, very warm, soft place in my heart for H&I because this is how I was introduced to AA. I love it. And I think it's fantastic when people say, I found AA. And my hat is off to you. But I've got to let you all know that AA found me again and again and again and again and again. And that's what our literature suggests. And that's what our program asks us to do. It says when the man with a solution, you know, like presents himself, you know, so like, I think our job as sober AA members is to go find people, you know, and I don't know what that looks like, social media, whatever, go to meetings. It's a lot easier to find meetings today than it was, you know, when this book was written, obviously, and published. But, you know, I think we have a duty and a responsibility to carry this message and not just wait, sit back and wait for people to maybe find us, you know, because if that's the case, then you probably have a different speaker here tonight. But there were people that brought meetings into that to the H&I center, to that treatment center. And I met some people and they were very friendly and kind. And when I got out, I had a really good idea that I was going to get back on my feet and I was going to, you know, like get an apartment, get a job and take over the world. And I had a meeting with a caseworker. And she suggested that maybe I go to a halfway house. And I was not happy about that idea. Like, I was 30 years old, I had 2 degrees. You know, I thought I was going to be able to pull myself out of this rut. And the reason why I mentioned that is because, I mean, it wasn't my idea, you know. For whatever reason, I was willing to kind of listen to some other people's suggestions and take some different advice. And I went to a halfway house. And it was rough. It was in a city called Rockville, Maryland, right outside of D.C. And it was rough, man. People were like stealing my shoes and my clothes and my food. And it's where I need to be, you know. It was where I needed to be. And I lived there for 6 months. And I started going to meetings because people, the same H&I people would come pick me up and take me to meetings. And I went to a meeting one night in a town called Kensington, Maryland. And a gentleman came up to me and he asked me my name and he asked me how I was and what I was doing there. I was a little put off by that. I was like, what do you mean? What am I doing here? It's an AA meeting. And I found that in my 10 years sobriety too, I think it's a valid question. You know, we come to AA, you know, like, why are you here? I got DUI. That doesn't mean you're alcoholic. And my parents think I need to be here. That doesn't mean you're an alcoholic either, you know? And that was one of my things. I had no idea what alcoholism meant, you know? I had ideas about what I thought it meant and, you know, the corny thing about brown paper bag and, you know, trench coat under a bridge, but it was never presented to me in ways, particularly in literature or verbally through someone, you know, discussing, communicating their experience, where I could really grasp it, you know? If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have a little control of the amount you take, then you're probably an alcoholic. So hold on now, that's probably the best description I've read yet, you know? And for me, it's like check and check. It says, if this or this, well, I have both, you know? Cause I do want to quit and I can't. And you know, the previous speaker, Paul, was talking about the phenomenon of craving. When I take a drink, I don't know what's going to happen. There's been a couple of times when I've just had one glass of wine and then caught it a night. Very, very infrequently. But it has happened. but I will ride that till the wheels fall off to prove to you why I'm not an alcoholic. You know, you see, you remember that one time in 1998 when that happened, you know, and the overwhelming majority of you know, regularity is when I drink, I don't know what's going to happen. And it's probably not going to end well either. You know, I'm a fall down, blackout, you know, get in fight type of drunk guy too, man. I pee places I shouldn't be. And I talk, you know, wrong things to wrong people. And you know, it was not a pretty sight, man. I've been beat up more times than I can count, you know? And it wasn't fun. I remember the previous speaker was talking about, you know, like the loneliness and the antisocial behavior. And I used to read that in the literature. It's talking about, you know, you give a man a drink and it becomes dangerously, even disgustingly antisocial. And I used to kind of buck on that because I think that means just holing up in a hotel by yourself, which I certainly did as well. But I'd be damned if antisocial isn't also at the bar thinking you know, you're running the place and no one wants to talk to you or like you and you're the loudest dude and talking, you know, smack to everybody. And probably I feel bad for the people who used to have to beat me up, you know, because I was just like that guy who wouldn't stop talking, you know, and your perspective shifts a lot. But I met that man, you know, that man Ali came to me and he asked me my name and asked me what I was doing there. And then he got my number. And he called me like a day or two later and he came pick me up for coffee and he took me to a meeting and he would become my sponsor. And I remember one of the first times we sat down at like a Pete's Coffee and started reading the book. And, you know, he sits across from me with his book and I have mine. And he's like, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I was like, "Shh, you know, take it easy, man. You know, there's a lot of people around here." And, the anonymity is a very important thing for me now, but I'm proud of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my life has never been better. And this is how this dude wore it, man. I mean, like I fell in love with this cat. He just, he just exuded AA, man. He was, you know, he didn't look like me and we didn't have the same backgrounds, but he just had, you know, his whole deportment shouting, he had an answer, you know, there was something about him. And I just loved the way, I'm so thankful that I met him when I did. And, you know, I'm convinced that, you know, there was certainly some divine play at work there that put him in front of me and me in front of him at the time that it was necessary. But I fell in love with that dude, man. And I tell you really quickly on, I was, you know, he told me things like, "Listen, I'm going to ask you and AA is going to ask you to do a lot of things that you don't want to do, you know?" And he was right. I asked him if he would sponsor me. He's like, "Yeah, I think I gotta go." He's like, "I need you to get 3 service commitments like yesterday." And I was like, "Ah," and he's like, "No, seriously, you know, no, like yesterday." And I was in a halfway house with no job, nothing else to do. Like I had the time. I thought that was a bit extreme. And, you know, but he was immediately starting to instill to me, you know, the benefits and the sheer necessity of service within AA, right? Because I'm a 2 hands out kind of guy and I have been my whole life, you know. What can I get? Let me hold that. Let me have some. And, you know, why? What do you mean why? Like, because I'm me. That's why. Like, I didn't earn it. I don't deserve it. But I'm me. So let me get that. And he wanted no part of that, you know. And I treated AA like that, too. You know, I showed up and I was like, "What can y'all do for me?" You know, whether it's just sign my course line or, you know, when I was around for long enough to realize how nice you guys were to, like, you know, listen to my stupid stories or, you know, buy me a, you know, a croissant or coffee or something. But I was a taker. And he started trying to teach me about, you know, what am I giving, you know, what am I giving to AA? I hear people all the time, "I love AA and I love AA." And the question is like, what do you do for AA? My sponsor said, "What is love?" He said, "You know, who do you love?" I said, "I love my mom." He said, "What does that mean?" And I said, "When I think about her, I get a warm feeling inside." He said, "That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That's like indigestion. That's not love." And and I was like, "All right, you know," and he's like, "Dig a little deeper here." So, you know, like, I want to do things for her. I want to make her feel comfortable. I want to, you know, be a good son and make her proud, right? Love is an action word, you know? So what are you doing for your mom, right? And it's the same way. Like, I love AA. Cool, man. What are you doing for AA? You know, you're showing up. You're drinking the coffee. You know, that's cool. You put a dollar in the basket. All right, that's cool. You know, and I'm not talking to anybody besides myself. Like, I'm a taker, man. So, like, what am I doing for AA? Well, like, you start showing up early, man, putting some chairs down. Start putting your hands out to people. I got a home group in D.C. pretty soon after meeting Ali, man. It's 450 young people in D.C. Ridiculous amount of young, sober people. And they voluntold me to get the greeter position, you know. So before the meeting, I'm sitting there shaking the hands of 450 people. My gosh, you know, it was ridiculous. And, you know, I'm somewhat social, but I was like, this is crazy, you know, and I was pretty uncomfortable with the whole thing. And, you know, and the people, they were like dressed nice and stuff. And I thought it was a fashion show. I was like, I told my sponsor, I was like, this is an AA, man. He's like, you don't know what you're talking about. I remember I sat with him. He's like, tell me what you know. No, granted, I've been going to AA for 6 years, right? And he's like, what do you know about Alcoholics Anonymous? Everybody's heard this story because everyone has 7-1-1. I was like, I know a little bit, man. I'm like, well, I've done some steps. I know about this and that. He's like, no. And he opens the book on the very first page of the book, and it's an all white page, and it says Alcoholics Anonymous in black letters. And he's like, that's what you know about AA. You know, he's like, you know, the name of our fellowship. And man, I was offended, you know, but he was right. You know, he was right. Cause I just didn't do anything. You know, I just wanted it to change, but I didn't want to take any action. And the truth be told, I just wasn't severely beaten up enough. You know, I wasn't spiritually drained enough through my own doing to be able to be willing to try something different. Right. I started taking steps with these dudes, and it was phenomenal. And I jumped in, man. And I'm incredibly lucky and blessed because I got sober in a place where people were really getting after it. You know, the meetings before the meetings, people were sitting around. They weren't talking really about sports or girlfriends or the weather. They were like, who's your sponsor? What step are you on? You know, and if you weren't like in that type of dialogue, they were like, beat it, son. You know, like they weren't rude about it, but they were just like, we're here to do this deal. And if you don't want to do it, like, no problem, no harm, no foul. They weren't rude about it, but they were just like steadfast in their commitment to AA, man. And I was scooped up by these cats, you know, sometimes willingly and sometimes not so willingly. I was in the halfway house. These guys were like, what are you doing? What are you doing tomorrow? I was like, oh, no, I got a thing, man. I can't do it. And they were like, you ain't got no thing. We're coming to get you, you know? And they would just come get me and take me to meetings and like show me a way of life, you know? And I started taking those steps, man. And it was beautiful, you know, and I had, you know, I got sober, we call them pigeons, your sponsees, right? Pigeons. So, you know, my sponsor had, you know, like 7 or 8 or 9 guys he was sponsored, had pigeon brothers. He said, you don't call them pigeons, man, because they carry the message. I was like, that's cute. And he's like, and because they shit on you. And I'm like, that's real, you know? And then I started sponsoring people a little while later and how true it is, but it's just the beauty of AA really, you know? And the nature of sponsorship in particular. And I tell you, it's been a crazy ride. I got to tell you too, I didn't even look at the clock. I don't know how much time, what time I'm supposed to stop at, but I have more obviously, but it's been such a beautiful treat to be able to be a part of these rooms. I came back. So I got sober and I was like 9 months sober and I was living in DC and I came back to San Diego where I now live. Sweet. Thank you, Leah. To do some 9-step amends. And people, I remember some people at the time, they were like, whoa, like you're flying to California to do amends. I was like, yeah, there were some people that were surprised about that. And I was baffled. I was like, what? Like it's like $300 for a round trip. Like I'm trying to be free, you know? Of course, I'm going to go make amends and get on an airplane, you know? And I made some of my first amends to my brother and a former employer and to my ex-girlfriend, who's one of the cars I had totaled in my second DUI. And I got to see, like, the power of 9-step amends and the promises. See, everybody talks about the promises, right? There's 3rd-step promises. There's 5-step promises. There's 9-step promises. There's 10-step promises. A lot of us talk about the promises, and we're referring to the 9-step promises. And I hear it all the time, and I'm sure I said it before, but like, you know, I got like 9 days sober, and I'm like, the promises are starting to come true, bro. And it's like, you know, you're not even doing the work, man. And there's probably like some, you know, like you might have got a decent night's sleep, you know, and some food, right? But it's like these, the true promises that are contained within the ninth step come with the ninth step. You know, it says, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. Halfway through what? Halfway through the ninth step, you know? And I got to go start making some of those promises or making some of those amends. And I remember I came back to DC after that trip to California, after making some amends. And some of them, like the people I running with, like, yo, man, like you look different, man. And I was like, yeah, I've been in California for a week. Like, you know, I have the impeccable coat of tan, you know, and I've been in California. And they're like, nah, dude, like you hold yourself differently. You're carrying yourself differently, you know? And that's one of the things about when we start to see the effects of, you know, a spiritual way of life, particularly facilitated through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we can see it in other people, man, you know, and like how powerful it is to be able to witness it and be a part of it, you know. And I got to make amends to my parents and some other people. I remember my sponsor wouldn't let me make amends to my parents for a while. Particularly because I wasn't financially responsible and able to. That's a big thing, right? So what's an amends, you know? Like, you know, the amendment to the Constitution is a change, right? It's a change for the better, we think. And I was full of sorries, you know? I'm sorry. And I think that's an amends, right? I think that's, you know, like somehow making it right. And it's not, you know? They tell my brother, I'm sorry. He's like, you are sorry, man. You are sorry, dude. And, you know, I got this one time when I was real drunk, I kicked somebody, one of my good friend's front door in because he locked it when we went out at night and I came home real late and I kicked his front door in. And his older brother knocked me out, but that's another story. And then, I bring that up because if I'm going to make an amends to this door, I don't go to this door with you know, splintered wood and nails hanging and say, sorry, door, you know, are we cool? Like that's not making the door whole. Like the way I make an amends to this door and obviously to this person is by rebuilding the door, making it fully functional again, right? And that's why it's not an apology, you know? I mean, if you say I'm sorry or I apologize, that's great. Like I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but it's a change. A change needs to take place. So you're not ready to make financial amends to your parents. You don't have the money. Hey, you know that 10 grand I owe you guys? Yeah, I know about it, but I don't have it. You know, like that's not making them whole, you know? So I took this man's advice on a lot of things, even when I didn't really agree with it a lot. And I tell you what, man, he's still my sponsor today, and thank God and God bless him. He lives 3,000 miles away, and I have a better relationship with him than I do with a lot of guys I sponsor who live 10 minutes from me, you know? And I think that's not a pat on my back or his. I think it's just a testament to the action and the work that we're willing to put in. You know, my relationship with my sponsor is a lot like my relationship with God or with Derek or with Layla. You know, if I don't talk and we don't communicate, we're probably not that tight, you know? And for me to just think that God's going to be on my side, take care of me, and we're going to be square one, and I don't pray, take action, meditate, seek, you know, it's a fallacy, you know? It's like any other relationship in my life, I have to put action into it. I have to put a lot of action into it through prayer, you know, through petitioning and through meditation, through listening and you know, trying to put myself as some type of a vessel for receiving. Oh, how cool is that? I tell you this. So I moved back to San Diego and I had a different style of AA than in DC, they were like, there was none of that, like, we'll love you till you love yourself. They were like, sit down and shut up, you know? Like, I remember, I always tell stories about my sponsor, and it makes him sound like a monster, but he's not, you know? I'm sitting in meetings, and I got, like, 30 days, and they're like, anybody want, like, they're calling on people to share. And they're like, anybody want to share? And I start putting my hand up, and my sponsor's like, no. Like, no one wants what you want, bro. No one wants what you got, bro, you know? And they were like, sit down, don't spill the coffee, you know? Just listen for a while. And I needed that too, man. You know, like I, you know, they were definitely tender and gentle with me, but they also just told me the truth, you know, they just told me the truth. And I mean, like, it's one of the most pivotal things about sponsorship in particular. It's like Paula said it, and I can actually echo it. Like, I haven't done anything perfectly in AA, but I tell you what, I've done very, very well. And it's not always easy, but being very honest with my sponsor, you know, being very, very honest with my sponsor. And that takes time. You know what I'm saying? To like build this relationship. I you know, I was lucky to be gifted pretty quickly that, you know, I trusted this man and I knew that he wanted the best for me and me to be happy and sober. And he wasn't trying to AA me down. You know, he just wanted me to be happy. Now I moved back to these to San Diego for a year and a half sober. People said, "Ooh, is that a good idea? I don't know if that's a good idea." And then some people who knew what they were talking about were like, "Nah, God travels. You'll be all right. You know, go ahead." Like there's AA in San Diego and everywhere else, you know? And, they said, don't make any big decisions in your first year of sobriety. I say a third step's a pretty damn big decision. You know what I mean? It's probably the biggest decision I've ever made, you know? So, as you see, like, I get a little nitpicky with things just because I think the book is the ultimate authority in AA. And I think there's things that I've learned and I've seen and I've experienced that have like shifted my views on things. But I think our experience is the strongest thing that we can hold on to, particularly within AA, but just in the rooms of life, you know? And I've softened up on that a little bit too. Because I've certainly come to understand that like my brand of AA is not for everybody, you know? I used to get fired a lot as a sponsor. It was great. And you know, I try and be helpful to people, but you know, there's different things that we can try and be available for. And I try and be honest with guys. Like my sponsor was honest with me. My sponsor cared more about me than he did about my feelings, you know? And he would tell me things that I didn't want to hear and that I wasn't prepared to hear at times. And I thought many times about getting a new sponsor and I thank God I didn't, you know? I need to say that, you know, we talk so much about this characteristic of willingness. And I got to tell you, man, I take zero credit for my willingness, you know? If I could muster the willingness to do whatever it is, work out consistently, eat well, stop drinking, do AA, then I wouldn't need you guys or AA or God. I would just do it. And I don't, and I can't. All right. So when I get this willingness, I'm graced it, I'm gifted it. And it's absolutely something that I haven't necessarily earned, but it's something that I need to recognize as being a essential component to my sobriety, but that I'm absolutely gifted this thing, you know? And the willingness to participate was there. You know, Nick, if you're still here, any other new people, if there's anything I can tell you, 10 years of sobriety has taught me is participation is the key. You know, our literature says admission of alcoholism and attendance at a few meetings is good indeed, but it's bound to be a far cry from permanent useful recovery. Meaning I can go to AA, sit there, say I'm an alcoholic, but it doesn't mean you're going to be sober and it damn sure doesn't mean you're going to be happy, you know? You're just going to be a dude in the room or a female in the room, you know? And there's no sobriety in that. There's no, you know, recovery in that. There's certainly not any happiness. There's another thing. I don't know if it's controversial. I'm just giving you all some of my opinions, which may or may not be the right platform. But I tell you what, I got sober a ton and I got drunk a ton and I never relapsed. I have never relapsed in my life because relapsing, as I understand it, is returning to bad health once gaining good health. And I never recovered. I never got well. I just put the drink down for a week or a couple of days or maybe a month or two or three or four. I think I had like 4 or 5 months at one point. But when I took that drink again, I didn't relapse. I had never got well. That's just my opinion, man. You know, and relapse is a cute word. It's like a bunny. It's like a bunny's name. I got drunk, man. You know, I picked up a drink and I got drunk. And I didn't have a solution, and it certainly wasn't a spiritual solution. And I did that a lot until I didn't, but it all came as the work of taking AA. And I tell you, there's been nothing so satisfying or impactful in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous as sponsorship. You know, obviously, you know, being a part of the meeting people, you know, being, you know, the social aspect of it is phenomenal. I think, I don't know, 85% of the 400 names in my phone are probably AA members, you know? And I love it like that. But it's, you know, they talk about like the fellowship. I mean, that's the other thing, like fellowship is incredibly important, right? But the fellowship is not going to keep me sober. As far as fellowship is not going to have Denny's after a meeting, in my opinion, you know, when we talk about like doctors who are fellows, it means a group of people with a common goal working towards a common goal. taking action toward this common goal. So just because I go sit with some people at a Denny's after a meeting, to me, that doesn't necessarily equate to fellowship, you know? It means that hopefully, like, we're taking action within this program. Like, I have a sponsor and I'm taking steps. I'm trying to be helpful, and I'm trying to stop being a taker. And that's the only, you know, self-centered to the core, man. I had to hardwire my brain to learn how to try and be helpful and thoughtful. And then, you know, I start saying things like, you know, his whole attitude upon life will change, right? Like, I stopped thinking I'm a victim. I stopped thinking that, you know, I've been dealt a bad hand, you know, or that this is just the way it is. And I see all these other people who are happy and sober, and like, there's nothing that I can say that makes that not true. I don't think that there's like hundreds or thousands, or to this point, over 2.5 million people on the planet who are conspiring to trick me into doing AA. You know, I think most of these people are just like living their lives and having a good time. And then they probably understand, you know, that by being a part of it, they get the benefits too. Ali said that to me real early on. He's like, listen, we're going to take these steps and you are going to benefit from it, right? But the main reason we're doing this is so that you can pass this on to the next guy. So from one of our first meetings, he's already making not about me, you know? I needed that, man. I was so selfish and self-centered, and I can't be today. That's where 10-step work comes in, you know? That's where constant vigilance and continue to keep an eye on what I look like. The drink in my hand today is certainly not my biggest problem, man, but like learning how to navigate life is a little bit, right? Stay tolerant, you know, with two little premature babies, you know? And I'm very fortunate to sponsor some guys too. And some of them are just as crazy as me, you know, and I love it. And they help keep me sane, you know? And, you know, the world's been nuts for the last year and a half, as we all know, but we find ways to adapt and be fluid, you know, and be dynamic and get on Zoom meetings and, you know, find sponsees and still be helpful and purchase the person's coffee behind you in Starbucks. And, you know, like, how can we be friendly to this world? How can I show up and give a little bit and be helpful and thankful instead of a taker? You know, I was not some scheming, you know, criminally minded guy, but I was just a jerk. You know, I was a selfish guy for a long time. And today, I don't think I am nearly as much. And I got to tell you, it's not because I decided differently. You know, I was taught differently by AA. And I think and I believe like AA is like batting practice. You know, I come here, especially when I'm new, and I learn how to do some very simple things, like show up when I'm supposed to, right? Or when I say I'm going to. And I learn how to, like, you know, say things and look people in the eye and be honest, and then start digging a little bit, like when I do step work and you know, having some faith and some courage and willingness, and, you know, in the third step. And then, you know, the opportunity to really face some things head on in a ninth step, right? And then I get to apply these out into the real world too, you know, in my business relationships, in my intimate relationships with strangers, in traffic, you know, and like these same principles in these same ways, like these little things I've learned within the rooms of AA, literally within the rooms, within four corners of a meeting, I get to bring out into my relationships with my parents, man, or my banker, or my wife. And that's crazy, you know, like that's insane. And it doesn't make sense until it does. You know, AA is largely theoretical until you do it. You know, you can read it and be like, this sounds great, you know. I can surf. Have you ever surfed? No, but I can do it. All right, you know, good luck, you know. But then you go out and fall and bust your ass a couple of times, you know, and keep going, then you probably can't pick it up, you know. And then you start teaching other people how to surf, you know. And then you got a little community, dude. And how cool is that, right? It's physical activity and everything else. But we're talking about, like, saving lives in AA, you know. It's incredible. I get super boosted off Alcoholics Anonymous, 10 years sober, you know, like a 19-year member, because it saved my life, you know, and the people that I've met within it have been like nothing else, you know. I play soccer at a high level. I come from a great family, but I didn't know what brothership meant, brotherhood meant. I didn't know what it meant to be like a solid person and show up, you know, and give freely, you know. I didn't know what that was. Like, you all taught me that. and my life's never been different or better before. I've lost, you know, I've had some sponsees, some pigeons die, you know, as a result of alcoholism. I've got married, you know, one of my pigeons was the reverend at my wedding, and then I was at his. I've walked some very close friends through the death of their parents. You know, all the beautiful and tragic and terrible and wonderful things of life that come up, you know, and I've been able to show up for it. And again, I don't take a bow for this. You know, this is not me. This is gifted to me by God. And AA is the vehicle that introduced to me to God. And the God I came in with is very different than the one I have today. And how beautiful is that as well, you know? And I think as long as we all can, you know, can continue to try to do a little bit better today than we did yesterday and try and be helpful to the next person, then we can be sober and we can be happy, you know? And we can meet, you know, in person next time, you know? I really appreciate you guys having me. It's been fantastic to be here. Alcoholics changed my, AA changed my life. I love it. I hope to see y'all at my home group sometime. Layla, great to see you. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Right.
My name's Pete Alcoholic.
Right. My gosh, let's give Pete another round of applause for that. Right. Thank you so much.